Hey, how's it going?
Hey,
my name's Michael L. I am an alcoholic. All right, and if you're 20 years sober, you get a sweatshirt. That's pretty much that's what I got. That's what I got going on. Today's a good day. Today is like I think 7,415 days. I found out if you get too many years and not enough days, you get drunk. So I try to stay on the 24-hour program. I'm an early riser. I get up like at 5:30, 5:45 every morning, and usually I wake up and think, oh my God, it's so early. And I kind of roll over, then I roll back over, and then I think I have another opportunity to stay sober today and carry the message of Alcoholics Anonymous, and possibly, God will put somebody in my path today that I can help change their life. And then by doing that, they can help change somebody else's life. Okay, Alcoholics Anonymous is very comfortable for me. When I first got here, it was comfortable for me. My first group in Fresno, California was the ODAC Club. The ODAC Club was much smaller than this place, probably about the size of this corner. You could still smoke cigarettes then. So there was a non-smoking section in the corner with three chairs if you didn't smoke. So you just get in the corner, and there was a non-smoking section. And there was parolees, and there was pimps, and there was hookers, and there was gangsters, and there was drunks, and there was addicts, and there was interesting women and interesting guys. Leave it at that. And I was one of them. And when I got there, it was real comfortable. You see, it was real comfortable because there was a lot of chaos in that group. And I was accustomed to chaos. You see, so I felt comfortable right off the top. But one thing I did not do is I didn't join the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. There's a difference between just going to meetings and joining the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I found that to be true after I kept relapsing. Okay, I didn't walk in 30 years ago and get it the first time. Okay, I didn't get it the first time. I'm going to give you a rundown of my history. I had a single-parent family. My mother raised me to the best that she could. She was the worst alcoholic I've ever seen. She used to get the big bottles of Smirnoff or Popoff, the really good vodka. And she would drink them. And I remember that. The bubble going up. And I knew that when that bottle came back down, there was going to be a transformation in her. And then she would see me because I looked so much like my father that I'd never met. I think I met him one time. And then when the anger would come out and the resentment would come out, she'd beat me. You know, she'd beat me and get a belt with a buckle side and just rip my legs up and say, you look just like your father, you little bastard. And see, that didn't make me an alcoholic. You know, when she couldn't take care of me when I was 4 or 5 years old and got molested, that didn't make me an alcoholic. Okay? I have a disease of alcoholism that I was probably born with. Okay, and it was unleashed when I took the first drink, you see. But I had the isms before that. Growing up, I felt different. I felt alone. I felt not good enough. I've always had a kind of an outgoing personality, so I would use that to placate the feelings of not being good enough. You see, I'll make them laugh, and they'll like me. You see, if I can just make them laugh, make them smile, they'll like me, right? And see, that's how I went through life. That's how I went through life. But drugs and alcohol, and I say drugs and alcohol because I'm an alcoholic first and foremost, but I practice the ABCs. Alcohol becomes crystal. Alcohol becomes cocaine. Okay? And that's just for me, you see. I have a switch that goes on after the third or fourth beer. I like beer, Budweiser. And after I drink that third or fourth beer, there's a switch that goes on, and I need something more powerful to placate the feelings that I have going on, to suppress the desires that I have going on, and that allows me to drink more, you see. So I may use the terms interwoven tonight as I speak, but so growing up, I was like everybody else. You know, pretty much teenager, started smoking weed, 12, 13 years old. I liked to get stoned. I really liked to get stoned. I was a stoner. You know what I mean? I grew up with Ozzy Osbourne and Van Halen, and I liked to get stoned. From the first drink, though, the first time I drank more than three beers was Heineken's and my buddies, and I just pounded them. Just pounded them. Just like I used to watch my mom drink that alcohol, that vodka, I would drink those beers. You see, and after that third Heineken went down, I was 13, and I felt okay for the first time. I felt okay. I felt lovable, likable. I felt funnier. I felt that it was okay. And I was like, man, this wonderful elixir, woohoo, I found it. And I would continue to drink and use other stuff the next 7-8 years of my life, okay? Going through high school, it got really bad for me in my senior year. I went to Fowler High School, senior year, where Fowler's at. Little small town, not too far from here. I went to Fowler High School and did well in school, played sports. Like I said, I was kind of popular. But the thing about I felt uncomfortable about was that alcoholic mother at home that didn't have a nice car, that old beat-up Nova, you know what I mean, who would come to school, the PTA meetings drunk, and embarrassed me, and all my friends, the rich guys, they would have, you know, Mercedes Benz, and they would have new cars and all that stuff. So those were the feelings that I felt. You know what I mean? I didn't have that. I was ashamed and embarrassed of who I really was and where I came from. And that was okay. You know, today it's okay. You know, I don't have to be something that I'm not. I don't have to pretend to be something that I'm not. You know, and so going through high school, you know, I started drinking my senior year like every night. You know what I mean? And then I would use other substances to add those party favors, you know. And by the time the last week, I was the senior class president. You know, the senior class president, the vice principal calls me and says, hey, you got 47 absences in first period. And we're not going to give you your diploma. So, but you can still walk with the class. You can still represent as a senior class president. And I was like, no, I'm out. I'm gonna drop out right now. So I'll see you later. You know, and I did that. And that was like, I'll show them. I'll just drop out. They want to have the senior class president. Yeah, I'm going to show them. That's, you know, that's the mentality. I'll get you. And I was watching all my friends graduate from the stands, drinking Budweiser in the stands, you know. And nobody, the parents that I knew, and nobody, like, and that's how I felt. I was always, like, invisible. You know, I was doing these things, but I was invisible. Nobody said, Michael, what are you doing? Michael, what are you doing? Nobody reached out to me. And I look back now, and it was kind of a cry for help. And I didn't get it. So what happened was, I have really good ideas. I don't know if you're like me, but I have like really good ideas when I'm drinking and when I'm using. I'm like, that is a good idea. This, yes. I'm going to hitchhike to L.A. That was a great idea. So I hitchhiked. I was telling my buddy about this morning. I went to Bakersfield this morning. And so I leave Fresno, hitchhike, get a ride to Bakersfield, and then Bakersfield a couple hours. I'm on California Boulevard in Bakersfield trying to get a ride out of Bakersfield. It took like forever. And then a carload of guys come, and they're on their way to Mexico, and they got a bunch of beer, and I jump in. I drink all this beer with them. We overheat on the grapevine. And that's how my life is. Like, I can be, like, nowhere, anywhere, and somebody will find me that has cold beer and drugs. You know? And I got to Glendale, and I had, like, I knew a friend of a friend who had a room that I could stay in until I got a job, and, you know, it just unfolded for me. And I got a job at Universal Studios. You know, as a security guard, because I'd never been busted for anything, so I called back. So I get this job as a security guard, and I'm at Universal Studios. You know, this is like a week later. You know, I'm basically homeless with a backpack with $20 and some tuna, and I'm hitchhiking to L.A., and I get there, and I get a job at Universal Studios, security guard, and all my job was is that there's a red light on the outside of the stages. When they're filming, that red light goes on, and you got to be quiet, so I'd assume. You know, and that was my job. And I did it for 2 days. And, no, I didn't lose my job. The story gets better. And this lady walks up to me, and at the time, I'm 20 years old, you know, I'm kind of good looking young guy. And she's like, hey, I've never seen you around here. I said, well, yeah, I just started a couple days ago. And she goes, how do you like it? I said, she's kind of cool, man. I saw Matlock earlier. You know, and, she goes, well, hey, you seem like a nice young man. I'm thinking, oh, she likes me. It wasn't like that, but. So she said, I'm the associate producer for Murder, She Wrote. And I was like, and I had watched Murder, She Wrote with my grandma. You know what I mean? So I was like, oh, I kind of like that show. You know, Angela Lansbury, she's kind of cool. And she goes, we need another production assistant. And since you have your security clearance, we can hire from within and I can pull your card and you can show up at stage 44 tomorrow and be a production assistant. And it pays like $3 more an hour. And I was making like, I don't know, back then like six bucks an hour. I forget what it was, but it went up to like 10 bucks an hour. And I was like, oh my God, I'm rich. You know, I'm in LA, I'm rich, I'm making 10 bucks an hour. I work for Angela Lansbury, okay? I'm an associate producer. Yeah, it was just like, wow. So I get there. The people on the staff of that show, of Murder, She Wrote, was, I didn't notice it then like I noticed it today, but they were so kind and loving to me. And they showed me a compassion and like they cared about me. And I was just like, you know, it's just, I don't know how I ended up here, but it's really cool. I like it. And I was in charge of the food. So if they had like 30 people on the set that day, a couple guest stars or whatever, special diets, I'd call the catering truck, show up, set up the food, fill up my JanSports bag. Because I had a JanSports bag. I'd fill that up with stuff. You know what I mean? Because I was still a thief. And I would fill that up and I would do my job and it was cool. And I bought a motorcycle and I lived in LA and everything was just working out. But I knew that I couldn't drink because when I drink, what happens? A, B, C. Every time. You know what I mean? Alcohol becomes cocaine. Alcohol becomes crystal. So I didn't drink, but I smoked marijuana. I smoked a lot of weed and I moved into that room on 114 West Windsor Boulevard in Glendale, California. And right across the street was a nightclub. And there was, on Fridays and Saturday nights, the lights would be going on. You'd hear the music going on. And I'd stand on my porch across the street and I'd smoke some weed. And I would see couples going by and single girls, and I wanted to be a part of that. But I knew that if I went into that club, I would probably drink, and then I'd lose Angela Lansbury, and I would lose all these things. And so I didn't go across the street. I never went across the street. I just stayed there and smoked weed. And, you know, but if you're like me, you can only smoke so much weed. Well, it makes you thirsty. It does make you thirsty. And, funny thing is that there was a Circle K right down the street from my house. We would go there and buy cigarettes and, you know, snacks or whatever. We'd go down there at midnight or whatever, and there's a guy that's working there. He's got the door locked, and he's passed out with a beer, passed out. And we're like, oh, my God, this dude's passed out. They need cigarettes. Shaking the door, and the door flies open. Oh, man, we should go wake him up. So me and my roommate run there, and we're like, hey, get up. And he's out. I mean, this guy was a real alcoholic. You know, he was passed out at work. I felt bad. I'm like, dude, what are you doing? Because I always want to help everybody else, but I don't want to help myself. See, because I have all the answers for everybody else. But so we took a bunch of beer. We took like six cases of beer, some cigarettes. And I don't even remember if we were concerned about the cameras or what. And kind of slapped him around, woke him up and left. And he did it again like a week later. But we didn't take the beer that time. The door didn't pop open. So now I've drank some beer. And when, you know, when you haven't drank beer in a while and you're drinking beer and you're doing pretty good, you got a motorcycle, you live in Southern California, you work for Murder, She Wrote. You know what I mean? You talk to Angela Lansbury every day. You see Matlock yesterday. You know, it was just like, and I was working for Major Dad part-time and Quantum Leap stopped back to us. So it was like my life was pretty good and I just drank a little bit. It's going to be all right. I didn't even start drugs. Smoke some weed. Yeah, but I get thirsty when I smoke weed, and you know, I drink. So it fell apart. And I got paid every other Wednesday or third Wednesday of the month, whatever, but they would send my check to my house. And it was always wrong. And this is the excuse I used for quitting Universal Studios, is that it was always wrong. Now, if they didn't pay me for Wednesday and Thursday. Now I got to go down, put a claim check in, get my money right. But when they would overpay me, like, dude, I only worked 4 days this week. I got paid for 7 in overtime. I wouldn't say shit. I would just be like, yeah, you know, because We like the good shit, but the stuff that affects us negatively, we think we're getting burned, and, you know, we don't want to make it right and all that stuff. So I end up quitting. This is about the end of my ride in Glendale. And now I'm drinking, I'm using, I found some really good crystal methamphetamine in a little town called Tahunga. And so I'm waiting for my check. They still owe me a check. My check comes, and I'm partying now. I'm riding my motorcycle around partying. I get my check. And 2 weeks goes by again, and I check the mail, and I'll be damned, they give me another check. And I'm thinking, well, maybe they hold back the first 2 weeks. Maybe this was my final check. Well, then 2 weeks goes by, and I get another check. And then another check. And then I'm posting up. On Wednesdays, man, every other Wednesday, I'm like, man, where's my check? And this went on for months, like 5 months. You know what I mean? And yeah. I made my nameless. One day it don't come, and I'm mad about it. I haven't worked in 5 months, and I'm mad because they didn't send me my check that I did not work for. Bastards, don't they know I was going to do stuff? So I come back to Fresno. I leave, come back to Fresno, and I got a job managing Domino's Pizza real quick. If you're like me, the big book says that we're above average earners. You know, most of us are workers. Not all of us, but a lot of us have the ability to get jobs, but not keep jobs. Kind of like sobriety. You know what I mean? We can get sober, but sometimes can't stay sober. So I could never really keep the good jobs that I have for very long. So I'm there, and once again, I know I can't drink. Can't drink because ABC. You know what I mean? I just can't drink. And I'm not even smoking weed at the time. So I think I might be hitting meetings every once in a while, but I wasn't a part of the fellowship, and that's a very important part, not just going to meetings. So long story short, I become the manager of Domino's Pizza. I'm doing really well. I got it. Car, everything's going good, and that town of Fowler I told you about, well, there was a party, and I hadn't been back to Fowler in like two or three years, and should I go to this party? Better not. I don't need to go to a party. Yeah, they want me to go. Well, they haven't seen me. Then the rationalization kicks in. Well, you can go back and show them how good you're doing. You show them your new car, take some pizzas with you, and they'd like that. That'd be cool. So there was a place in Fresno called Butterfields. I don't know if you ever heard of Butterfields. It was a brewery, and they had a Butterfields keg at this party. And I show up, and I'm not drinking, and I'm eating pizza. That makes me thirsty, too. And I think, man, Butterfields. I've never had the Butterfields. You know, the keg, when you put it in ice, it's like cold and... It's very inviting. I think they had red cups, too. I was like, man, I just had one or two. It's no big deal. You know, I hadn't drank for like a year now, so. I'll just have one. So I had one of the Butterfields beer, and it was really good. God, it went down so smooth. It went down so smooth. I'm going to have one more, and then I'm going to leave because I have to open up the restaurant tomorrow morning. And I drank that second beer, and I tried to go home. I didn't make it, but I tried. I got in my car. Somebody needed to ride to Fowler. They had to go home, too. I dropped them off, and I rolled a stop sign. I just drank two tumblers of beer, like, within the hour. DUI at .10, like, just barely the drunk limit. So I did a DUI. This is December 2nd, 1990. So I'm not even 20 yet. You know what I mean? I'm 19 years old. My birthday's in a week. I'm 19. I get busted. I lose my job at De Chico or at Domino's because you can't have a DUI. And it's not now. I have this car. I don't have money to make the payment. I know how to sell drugs. I know drug people, and I know how to party still. So I jump back into that. In a short period of time, I'm an intravenous drug user. That's how I use drugs. I like to drink beer like this and intervening shows like that. That's my story. I got back on cocaine really, really bad. Just like in no time. And I lost the car. I lost everything. It's just one of those, like, man, should have stayed at Universal Studios. Should have never had that beer. Shouldn't have done this. Shouldn't have done that. But I did. So now what am I going to do? Now it's unleashed. The allergy is unleashed. The mental obsession has been unleashed. I couldn't stop if I wanted to. So, do you have any thinkers in the crowd? People like overthink and just think about stuff and just like think about stuff. Now I'm thinking about it. Or how about this one? I'll think about it. You're not going to think that's bullshit deal. That means no, by the way. I'll think about it means no. The majority of that. So I'm watching 2020, and there's a bank robbery special. Talks about all these bank robberies going on. That's kind of interesting. Bank robberies, wow. They go on to tell you exactly how these guys are robbing these banks with a note or just demanding money, threat of intimidation and violence. I'm thinking, man, I can do that. I can do that. So I did that. The next day, I went to the Bank of America in Kowloon, and I went in there, and this was before the strike law. There's still strikes. And I robbed this bank. I told them I had a gun. I didn't have a gun. Got some money, bought some drugs, bought some beer. Got super high for like a week. And then I came down with no money, no nothing, no car. I'm in a motel room. I'm thinking, oh, my God. I robbed a bank. Dude, I'm going to go to prison forever when they catch me. This is horrible. What did I do? At that moment with God, oh, my God, what am I going to do? I always go to God when I'm in trouble. God, what am I going to do? I don't know if he told me or the other guy told me, but I robbed another bank. Because I was out of money. And the obsession had been kick-started. I had no choice. Right? I mean, you're going to prison anyway. It's like after you drink the first drink. I drink. I might as well drink another one. I'm already drunk. I can start over tomorrow. So that lasted for a couple of years. I kept robbing banks over and over again. And I was getting smaller and smaller. I was like 155 pounds. Usually about 200, 220, depending on if I'm working out. But the hole in my soul, my heart, kept getting bigger and bigger. Bigger and bigger. One night, I'm drunk and high in a hotel room. I've been on the run from the FBI, local authorities, so it's San Joaquin Valley for a couple of years. And I'm in this motel room, and when you're drunk and loaded on dope, the fan in the bathroom, it sounds like a helicopter. But I think God was in that fan. Because for some reason I said, Father, forgive me of sins. I don't even know where I heard that. Maybe growing up in church. And I said, Father, forgive me of sin. And I woke up the next morning. I'd like to say that I changed my life, turned my leaf over. That's not what happened. And I thought, well, get out of money, out of drugs. I didn't have a car. I had a car for a while, but I lost another car. Can't keep shit. I always lose stuff. And so I called the taxi. The taxi picked me up. I told him to take me to the bank. I got to cash the check. I thought, I know what I'll do. And remember those thoughts? The song was like, bing, I know what I'll do. I'll go to the bank right across the court, from the courthouse, right next to the jail, right across from the police station in downtown Fresno. In a taxi and rob that bank. That's what I'll do. I did it. I got like 40 grand out of the mercantile. And I get in the taxi to leave. I'll just go through and turn right. We'll go right by the jail, right by the courthouse. Turn right, go right by the Fresno police station. And I feel like I have all the power and all the control. My grandma raised me in the church. She just let me drive from Fresno to Sanger when I was 12. So I'd always go to church with her. I'm like, hey, grandma, go to church. Let's go. Get in the car. And I knew about a God. I didn't have a personal relationship with Jesus Christ or God or any God other than my God. And she used to take me to Coney Island Chili Dogs, which was one block over from the bank I just robbed. Like, you could throw a rock. So I went around this big city block, came back, and I saw the Chili Dogs, and I'm thinking, man, I should get some Chili Dogs. And that was my best thinking. I should tell the cab driver to pull over. I got $40,000. I'd get out and get some Chili Dogs. I just robbed that bank right over there. And I know rules of bank robbery. You're not supposed to stay within a mile radius. You're supposed to get the hell out of it. But the Chili Dogs got me, man. I'm gluttonous, too. Pride, anger, greed, gluttony, lust, envy, sloth. Gluttony, man, I love to eat. You know what I mean? I was hungry, too, because I loved it so much. So I go in, eat these Chili Dogs. Their God, they were so good. I went next door to the pawn shop, bought some stuff, like, you know, a watch and a golden chain or something. I had all this money. And when I walk out, a unit goes by and he sees me. And I'm thinking, oh, did he see me? Oh, did he see me? So I walk over to the Greyhound bus station. There's a taxi there. I jump in the taxi, and they get me on the freeway. I was coming back to Selma. So I get busted. So now I'm busted, and they indict me on 9 bank robberies. Crazy, you know, that's some crazy shit for a guy that just wanted to drink and get loved. You know, a guy that was a senior class president 2 years ago and used to work for Andrew Lansbury. Now he's facing prison time. Huh, yeah, right? Jeez, can you believe that? In the federal system, they are mandated to give you what's called a bond hearing. Okay, so this bond hearing, you go before a magistrate and they say, okay, you know what, you want to put your house up, can you secure bail, what's your charges? They're not going to give me no money. I don't have any money. They took all my $40,000. You know what I mean? They already took that. You know, I ain't got nothing. I have no house. I have no wife. I have nobody that's going to, yeah, all sign for him. He'll come back. That's not happening, right? So I get there, and this is where God started intervening in my life. He had started it before that, but I didn't notice it until this day. The magistrate was out sick or whatever. Okay, so there was an old retired judge by the name of Eugene Price. Eugene Price was the chief judge of the Eastern District of the United States. He was like a big deal. You know what I mean? He's retired, and he was a big deal. But he was super old, like 85, right? So he tells me, he calls me boy. He's boy, stand up. I'm thinking, oh, God, he's not even going to tell me that. Shit on that. You're bad, all this stuff. And he's looking over my file. He's looking in his file. He's looking at all these pages. Looking. Shaking his head. When the judge or the DA shakes their head, it's not a good sign. He says, boy, I'm going to give you a break, and I suggest you take it. And I was like, oh, what is that? He goes, we're going to get you an attorney point for pretrial if possible. And the United States District Attorney jumped up and said, Judge Price, you can't do that. He's dangerous. So Judge Price, this is where God was like, boop! And Judge Price looked at the United States District Attorney and says, perhaps, since I'm retired, you've forgotten who I am. I'm the Honorable Eugene Price, Chief Justice of the Eastern District of the United States. And I can do anything I want. And I was like, ooh, you know, when you're like, yeah, yeah, Judge Price, yeah, yes, you can. Call me boy anytime. You know what I mean? Anytime. I got you, yeah. So they had to do an interview with me to make sure I wasn't like crazy and be like killing people. And they interviewed me. I was in and out of jail within like 2 weeks and put in turning point for pretrial. Okay. And like, it was just crazy. You know, this happened. And then like a week after that, the funding for the pretrial services was out. So I was going to have to go back to jail. But Judge Price made them let me go on pretrial. Facing 9 felony indictments of bank robbery. And all I had to do was promise to show up to courts, not drink and not use, and go to AA meetings. It had never been done in the United States. Never. I don't know if you got a God like I got, But that time that he allowed me, because my innermost prayer was my grandma. I just wanted, because I thought I was going to prison for like 10, 15, 20 years. I didn't know. You know, I just wanted to see my grandma again. She was the only woman that ever loved me. You know, she was the only one. And she was old. And I knew that if I was going to go to prison, I probably wouldn't see her. So I got to go home and take care of her. Take her to the bathroom, wipe her butt, put her to bed, make her food during my pre-trial time. And right before I got sentenced, she passed away in my arms. And I knew that there was something going on behind the scenes. Okay? So I showed up to court. I went to those AA meetings. I got a sponsor. I didn't work the steps. I didn't try to strengthen my relationship with God, because I really didn't have a relationship with God. I had a belief. And you say, oh, I believe in God. Do you? How do you? When I believe in something, I work towards it. When I believe in something, I work for it. When I believe in something, I cherish it and protect it and strengthen it and feed it. So I didn't believe in God. Not then. Not yet. So I went to prison. I went to prison for 4 years on 9 bank robberies. They dropped 7 counts, indicted me on 2. Before the strike law, somebody said about a strike law. So yeah, I got strikes. Yeah, before the strike law, I think that's a bogus law. Dude, how can you commit a crime before the strike law and now you got strikes? That's ex post facto, that's what we call it. After the fact. So I get out. Okay, I get out, I get a job. Same thing. You know, we do the same things. We get a job, and you know, I thought if I get a girlfriend, I get a job, and I get a car, a place to live, I'm all right. And I'll go to AA, just, you know, walk in and see the people I know, and yeah, everything's good. Everything's good. If you're like me, I do overindulgence. So whatever you find that's good, you do more of. So I was working like 100 hours a week, you know, and before long, I get thirsty. Before long, I get thirsty. When I drink, A, B, and C. And nothing's changed. Nothing's changed. Everything I learned, all those spiritual experiences. Now, the difference between the experience and awakening, it says as a result of working steps, we had a spiritual awakening. I had spiritual experiences throughout my life. You know those little, they call them God shots? When someone's like, oh my God, yeah, that's great. And then the next day you forget all about that God shot. And you're stuck back in here. And you're doing and you're living the same way you were before the last spiritual experience. Sometimes those pink clouds are pretty good. But you better have a pink parachute. You know what I mean? Because it's not going to last. So you know what? Things get worse for me. They never get better when I'm drinking, when I'm using. They never get better. They just get worse. Progressively worse. My sister used to come save me from my alcoholic mother, my older sister. She was 14 years older than me. So when I'm 4, 5, 6 years old, she'd save me from the beatings, take me to her house, and I felt safe. I felt safe and loved with my sister and my grandma. Okay? My sister was one of us. She never found the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous or Narcotics Anonymous or church or anything. On April 15th, 1998, she took her life. I'd gotten out of I was working at another pizza place, and her favorite song came on the radio, and I went to go visit her that day, and everything was good. The next day, that very same song came on the radio, and something told me to call your sister. And I called her, and she was in a fight with her partner. She was lesbian, and I was thinking, and her partner told me to come over and help her with my sister, and I was like, I don't think I want to go get in the middle of two lesbians fighting about their relationship. That just doesn't sound something that I should do. You know what I mean? That's probably not right. So I didn't go. I didn't try to help her. And she killed herself that night. She shot herself in the head. So that was my last relapse. It was actually after her funeral in 98. Okay. Almost immediately, I went back to selling drugs, running the streets. The same thing everybody else does. Okay. I get busted again, but now I have what? Strikes. I got 2 strikes. Yeah, woo! I got 2 strikes and new felony charges. Okay? So it's not going good. And it was a simple possession with sales. But I got to bail out for the first time because I had a bunch of money because I was selling dope. So I bail out. I'm out on bail. And I'll be dang, while I'm out on bail, I get busted again. You know when you get busted when you're on bail for doing the same thing you're on bail for? The judge does not like that at all. I mean, they're freaking get fired up. So I bail out again. So I lose my first bail. Now I'm double bailed. I got two cases, but they don't know about my strikes because they're felony strikes in the feds, not the state. Ah, a little bit different, right? So I have this great idea. I'll go to a drug program. So I went down to the Salvation Army, signed up, got approved, went back to court, and they were going to sentence me to go to Salvation Army, right? It's all good. So I'm going to court, and this is another good one here, is that right before they sentence me, the clerk comes in and says, "Your Honor, hold on." And I'm thinking, no, that's hold on. She takes a file that I'd never seen before to the judge and gives it to her. And the judge, remember how Judge Price looked at me like this? So she starts looking, and they're my federal cases, my federal file. Now she sees strikes, which I can't go to Salvation Army because now I have strikes, which the deal that I had previously made with the other judge is no good. She goes, "Mr. Lacey, you have two strikes. You have two new felony cases. I can't honor this deal." And then the district attorney, once again, wants to remand my custody, but I showed up and I stayed clean during that time. So the judge let me go. When the judge let me go, it was on and cracking. I was not going back to court with two strikes. I wasn't going to get struck out. I'd rather die in the street. Okay? And that's how I felt, honestly, at the time. So I consult a private attorney. And the private attorney says, "Well, you know, you got strike cases, you got two good cases, you're out on bail. It's going to be, you know, it's not looking good. So I need a $15,000 retainer." And she says, "Yeah, $15,000? What do you want me to do, rob a bank?" I don't know. So I had a bunch of stuff accumulated from selling drugs within a couple of years. Sold some of that, got him some money down, and then they just want to keep on more money. Because I came up with like $10,000, and they were like, "Yeah, we got a lot of work to do. I got to grease some palms here." And he starts pumping me up, "But I know the district attorney that's assigned to your case. I helped her get her job." That sales talk, man. They got me. I'm like, "Really? Yeah. I need your program." Thinking, "Gee, well, how much is that going to cost?" "Yeah, I'm going to need another $10,000. This fucking dude wants me to rob a bank. He really does. But I'm not going to do that. I'm not in that old days, bro. I'm not. You know, and I'm clean. I'm not drinking and I'm using it during this time." You know, I'm thinking, "Oh my God, well, the only way I know how to make that kind of money is selling pounds of methamphetamine." I got a family thing going on. You know, I know some of you guys have family members that are kind of connected or know people that know people. So I had this thing going on, and I knew somebody else who wanted a large amount of methamphetamine. So I brokered a deal. I didn't go through with the deal. But when I went to go talk to the person that I was talking to about the deal, he was a Fresno police officer with ICE net. So now I'm out on two cases on bail, trying to go to a drug program and brokering a deal for 6 pounds of methamphetamine. I tell him, "Dude, 6 pounds is a lot." I'm thinking, "What if I get you 2 pounds and if everything goes right, we'll do the rest?" What's the difference between 2 and 6 pounds, first of all? That's when you don't want one of those thoughts, you know, what's the difference? So I go get 2 pounds of methamphetamine, I roll up, and the ICE net's ready for me. I had a tech knife in my case that I traded an ounce of dope for like the day before that I'd never shot or never even taken out of the case. I don't even know what a tech knife is. I'm not a gangster. They bust me with a SWAT team ICE net. I'm busted. And then when they opened the truck and took out that tech knife, they put it on top of the car and says, "We got him." And when he said that, I was free. I knew I was going to prison for the rest of my life. They were going to shoot me. And you know what? I was okay. I was okay with that. Because the life I'd led up to that point, it was, I was surviving. I could never love anybody or really have them love me. I kept everybody at a distance. I felt like the loneliest person in the world driving around at 3 o'clock in the morning, high as a kite, drinking and using all alone. Like nobody else existed on this earth, just me. And nobody understood my pain. So now I'm busted again. I'm in jail, I'm going to prison. Probation is recommending 187 to life. All my financial stuff I had, I didn't give him the second 10 grand because I was trying to get the second 10 grand together and I had like 6 grand. So I had some cars and stuff. I got another private attorney. He used to be the district attorney for Fresno. Huh. What a coincidence. He was also in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Wow. How does this story happen? How does it happen without God inviting it? So I go to court. I'm in jail, you know, I'm going to prison forever. You know, I mean, that's kind of my mentality. We're talking about Delancey Street. You ever heard of Delancey Street, anybody?
Yeah.
It's like a program where you sign, like, I'll go to prison forever if I don't complete this program. It's like 2 years in San Francisco at a restaurant. I was like, that sounds pretty good. I'll go to Delancey Street. I'd rather go to Delancey Street than Wasco. You know, I'd never been to state prison before. I'm thinking, wow, yeah. Delancey Street. Well, they brought in a special methamphetamine prosecutor from the Capitol to prosecute me. I knew I was special, but not that special. So the judge was going to do it. The judge was going to give me the deal to sign whatever. Well, I forget what the lid was. He was endorsing it. And she stood up and said, Mr. Lacey, you're not going to Delancey Street or any other street. And I was like, oh, that was cold-blooded. That was kind of poetic in a way, but that was cold-blooded, man. You know? And she wouldn't sign off on it, so I went to prison for 11 years to 8%, which is 8.8 years. So the only way I know how to live is have power and control. By doing that, I sell drugs. So I went to prison and sold heroin. Okay, I hadn't drank or used in some time. My spiritual experience is this. I was in my prison cell a couple years ago. And I looked around my cell and I had all the power, all the control. I had the keys to the yard. And I heard a voice say, just like I'm talking to you, and this is all you will ever have. This is all you'll ever have. I didn't want it. I started going to meetings right after that. I got rid of my heroin. I started contacting a sponsor. What's that clock saying? We're almost out of time. Okay, I'm going to wrap this up. So I got out of prison. The first thing I did was what? No, I didn't rob a bank. I didn't get a girl, get an apartment. I didn't do those things. No, I knew that didn't work. I tried something different. I joined the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. I've been going to meetings almost every day since. I got a sponsor. I worked the steps. I'm a part of a local fellowship. I speak all over. They like my bullshit. I know this works. If you like good stuff that works, that's me. I like good stuff that works. If this didn't work, I would have bounced 7,414 days ago. Keep coming back, go to meetings, get somebody you can trust, and most of all, love one another. Thank you.